this artist hired an agent because he wanted to sell some of his paintings. So the agent arranged for the painter to have an exhibition of his works at a major museum for sale. And the agent called the artist and said, "Well, I've got good news and maybe troubling news for you." He said, "Well, tell me the good news." He said, "Well, the good news is actually wonderful. A man came in yesterday inquiring about your paintings, inquiring about how much they, what was the cost of them. And then he asked me, what happens to art after the passing away of the artist?" And I explained to him that what always happens is the painting's value, the painting skyrockets. I told him, in your case, that would certainly be the case. So he immediately bought up all of your paintings, every one of them. Artist said, "That is wonderful. What's disturbing?" He said, "He's your doctor." That would be a test, wouldn't it? We're studying the book of Hebrews. Remember what the thread is? The essential theme, how God speaks to me. We've seen a lot of misconceptions of how God speaks to me. All of those misconceptions have to do with a fundamental misconception about the nature of our relationship with God once we have been born again. And today, we're in Hebrews chapter 12. We began it last week. It was so important. We're continuing on. And this is an issue. We have fundamental misconceptions, and that's the whole issue of discipline. We're going to see today, God does discipline me, but it's not at all how we think it is. And again, we say discipline. We say that, but what do we really mean? We mean punish, don't we? What do we? But we think that. When today in the Christian community, when you talk about God, when people say, "Well, God will discipline us," what they mean is punish. Yes, but you're right, it means teaching.
Test.
Yeah. Or God will chasten me. God will rebuke me. God will take me to the woodshed. Don't we tend to have this conception? First, I sin. We get out of line. Then, God punishes me until I get back in line. And how does He punish me? He punishes me by sending adverse circumstances into my life. Isn't that what we think? Or let's think of the reverse. If we're in a trial, in an adverse circumstance, don't we tend to think, one, well, God's punishing me for something I did? Now, unfortunately, we can always reinforce that, because if we think, we'll always find something we did. If you don't, look again. So it's easy to connect dots that shouldn't be connected. I did this, now I'm in this, God sent it to punish me. And it's so ironic. Hebrews chapter 12 is the most often used text to prove that God does those things to us. And the irony is, it's the clearest chapter that says He does not. All right, let's begin with the word discipline. Boxing in God's gym, the old 1-2. Let's begin with the word discipline itself. We see that word many times in the New Testament. You'll notice, you'll see the word discipline. And every time, it means in some way teaching. However, the word we see in English as discipline is really many different Greek words. But all of them are some different aspect of teaching. Now, some of the words we see translated discipline are just classical general teaching. And that's when we find precepts in the Bible. Counsel, advice, things we should do that would get benefit to our lives. Now, Hebrews 12, the word discipline, also means teaching. But Hebrews 12 is a teaching of a much more personal nature. See, most of the precepts in the Bible are general in nature, and the unbeliever to some degree can follow those precepts. For example, the unbeliever can follow the wisdom of Proverbs and he'll take benefit from it. Hebrews 12 is personal teaching. And if we understand what discipline is in Hebrews chapter 12, we'll welcome it. We'll want it. Because the purpose of discipline is to produce two things in our life. We're going to see a lot of twos today. Now, before we look at the passage, I'm going to review. First, we want to establish the context of what discipline is. Secondly, there's an image here. There's a picture here that we don't want to miss. And third, we want to clarify the nature of the relationship between the teacher, God, and the student, us. First, let's look at the context. As a quick review from last week, Hebrews 12:1, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. So, we want to establish the context. Yes, discipline is in the context of sin. In fact, sin triggers discipline. The question, though, is whose sin is it? Is it our own sin that triggers discipline? The answer is no. Verse 3, fixing our eyes on Jesus. He's our example. In what way? Verse 2, yes. Fixing our eyes on Jesus. Then verse 3, for consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself. So, yes, he's talking about sin. He's talking about discipline in the context of sin. But do you see, it's not our sin? Because what kind of sin caused Jesus grief? Was it his own? No, it was a sin of the world coming against us. So that's the context of discipline in the passage. It's not triggered by our own sin. It's that when we are sinned against. In a bigger context, it's when those trials, those circumstances, those testing situations come into our lives. That's what he's talking about. God steps in with discipline. But you see, it's not because of what we've done. So certainly it would not be to punish us, would it? In fact, if we think it's to punish us, then what will happen? Finish the rest of verse 3. So that you will not grow weary and lose heart. If we think God's punishing us, that's exactly what will happen. We'll grow weary, we'll lose strength, which is the opposite of what we want, and we will lose heart. That means we will become faint, we will become fearful. So, the context is, it's those attacks, it's those testing, those trials, adverse circumstances of life. That's the context of discipline. Second, the imagery. There's a picture here. If we miss the picture, we'll miss the whole thing. Verse 4, you have not resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving. Hold that thought against sin. Is it your sin? No. No. It's the attacks against you. Now, the word striving literally means boxing. That's why we're in God's gym. So, the world comes at us, striking blows at us. We're in a boxing ring. And we go down to verse 11, and the word trained, those who have been trained by it, is literally the word, is where we get the word gymnasium. So, actually, what we would say is development in a gymnasium, and that's what discipline is. Many of the words in Hebrews chapter 12 are tied to the context of a gym. The word chastening, rebuke, reprove, all those words, they're badly translated, but if we put them in the context of development of a gym, they'll all make sense today. So, here's the image. The world comes at us with blows, those adverse circumstances of life, those trials. But God is our coach. He's in the corner with us. He's our personal trainer. He's developing our skills in the ring. That's what discipline is. So, one, the context is, it's those trials, tribulations, adverse circumstances of life. Second, the imagery here is, this all takes place in God's gym. Not Gold's gym. This is God's gym. It's different. It's supernatural. So, you see, it doesn't matter what the source of those difficulties are. It doesn't matter what people's motivations are. And by the way, it also doesn't matter if we have helped trigger some of those trials. It doesn't matter. Once it gets into God's gym, He takes care of it. He's our personal trainer. Now, third, the nature of the relationship between the coach and us. Four times in Hebrews chapter 12, we see the word sons. And that word is a specific word that means full-grown adult sons and daughters, not little children. Now, you don't spank grown adults. Why? They can hit you back. That's my rule of thumb. Don't hit somebody if they can hit you back. And it served me well over the years. Now, think relationship with grown children, sons and daughters. You don't spank them. You develop them. You counsel. And that's what he's doing. He's our personal trainer, developing us to deal with those blows that come in life. What if you retained a personal trainer and you went to visit him and he pulled out his belt and said, okay, we're going to start with a good spanking? I don't think so. That'd be ridiculous. So, when those blows, when those adverse difficulties come into our life, and they do, don't they? Yes, they do. God's intention is not that we be whipped. His intention is those blows don't land. But let's be honest. It sure feels like some of them are landing, doesn't it? Remember he said, you have not yet shed blood. His intention is we don't get bloody. In fact, the blows don't land. Again, sure feels like it sometimes. Now, there's a simple reason why we feel beaten. I'm sure you could agree with me. I would say in many of those times I thought, that blow landed. I felt it. There's a simple reason. It's not God's intention for that to happen. The reason is, we go into that trial with incorrect understanding. We have misconceptions, and that impacts what we do. And then we cause the pain to ourselves. You can see how that works today. The world comes at us. Those adverse circumstances come into our life. Hebrews chapter 12 explains how we have a correct understanding of what's happening. And here's the positive way of looking at it. If we approach those trials and circumstances with the correct understanding, we will automatically do what's correct. If we go into that trial with the wrong understanding of what's happening, we will automatically do what's wrong. And we may hinder the resolution of our current trial, and we may trigger future trials. So here's the old one too. Here's two things to know about a trial. Actually, here's a better way to look at it. Here's two things that God guarantees that He will do. Well, I guess we could say those are things to know too. Any trial, again, it doesn't matter if you had nothing to do with it, if you had everything to do with it, if it was partial, God guarantees the same two things. And we need to know these things. One, the fight has been fixed. This is God's gym. He does whatever He wants. And for everyone who's been born again, we go into His gym. He's fixed the fight. He's rigged it. He's guaranteed we will win. So we go in, whatever trial we're in, we need to have the understanding it's already fixed. It doesn't matter what the intention of maybe people who caused it. It doesn't matter what the intention of the world was. It doesn't matter if I helped to trigger it. God says, don't worry, I fixed it. This is my gem. So when the trial starts, picture God going, I've got it fixed. That's the first thing to know. And let me say this again. If we go into it with that understanding, we will automatically do what's right in that trial. That's the first thing He promises. It's guaranteed you win. And secondly, the second thing God does is, not only will He work that trial out, He will use it so that it produces benefit in our lives. Now, again, if we don't understand that, those two things, you know what will happen? When that trial comes, we'll start fighting. We'll start flailing away. We'll do what's wrong. We'll hit our head up against the ring ourselves. And we'll bloody ourselves. We beat ourselves through doing what's wrong. Did you hear about that plane that crashed in the Congo from a crocodile that got loose in the eye? I don't know how big the crocodile was, but I know he was brought on in a carrying bag. He couldn't have been that big. The crocodile starts leisurely walking down the aisle, and people panic, and they stormed into the cockpit. Tipped the plane over, the plane crashed. When I read that story, I thought that's exactly what we do in times of trial. God had no intention of the blows landing on us, of us becoming bloody. But we start reacting wrong because we got the wrong understanding, and we bring the bloodiness, the beating, on ourselves. So it's interesting. When times of trial come, God promises He'll do two things. One, it's fixed. Two, I'll make it not only so that you win, but something better comes out because of the trial. It's interesting, God says He'll do two things. And what's interesting is we have two misconceptions about trials. Verse 5, you've forgotten the exhortation. Well, that's the word dialogue. They got to make everything religious sounding. And you have forgotten the dialogue which is addressed to you as full-grown sons. Now here's the first misconception that we have, the first wrong thinking we have about trials. My son, again, full-grown son, do not regard lightly. It says, do not despise the discipline of the Lord. And the word discipline there is a word that means development, specifically training in a gym. Now, he said, don't hate what God is developing in you. Now, let's just pause for a minute and think. If discipline meant punishment, well, of course we would hate it, wouldn't we? Now, but if we understand two things, what? It's fixed. It's rigged. We're going to win. And secondly, we'll benefit from it. We'll approach that trial with peace.
Replace that word discipline with developmental training.
That'll work for me. The word discipline. There's not an English equivalent for many of these words in here. And the reason is, they're all in the context of that physical training in the gym. The word discipline, literally, it means development. Training, and so yes, developmental training. How about that? Glad I thought of that. Now, again, I don't want to stop stressing this. If we in that trial and we despise it, we hate it, we will automatically do what's wrong. Now, what does that mean? That means we will compound the current trial we're in. And we may trigger future trials. Keep beating our head against the wall and saying, why has God punished me? If, on the other hand, if we are at peace in that trial, knowing it's rigged, it's fixed, we will automatically do what's right and minimize future trials. So that's the first thing. The first issue is, don't despise it. There's no reason to. He's developing something good. And I'll show you in a minute what the two benefits are. Here's the second misconception or wrong thinking we bring into a trial. Verse 5, nor faint. Literally that means become weak-kneed, become afraid. Now what's happening here? He says, first we hate it, then we get afraid. Well, isn't that exactly what we do? For just being in a trial, we hate it. I don't know about you, when I'm in a trial, I don't enjoy it. And again, as I said last week, maybe it's just something quirky about me, I don't like pain. So just being in a trial, we don't like it. And then it's compounded by another problem. Then we start worrying, how's this going to come out? Is everything going to unravel? So I hate it already. And then it's compounded by, how's it going to work out? And then I get afraid. We go faint. Now, why? Well, part of it is that we see these words like, when you are reproved by Him. Some translations say rebuked. Now, I'm sorry. Wouldn't that be a nonsensical sentence? Don't hate it when God rebukes you. Don't hate it when God punishes you. Yeah, right. He's going to whack you, but you shouldn't hate it. Actually, the word reproved means, the way to capture the correct meaning is put a dash between the two syllables, re and proved. It means literally proved again. That's what it means. Doesn't mean rebuked. Re-proven. What does that mean? Well, if we say re-proven, that automatically means two things. One, the current trial we're in, the good news is it will end. And secondly, when it does end, it will be proven what God said. He fixed it. See? So God says, I told you it was fixed. When we get to that trial, it's like God saying, nanny, nanny, boo, boo, I told you it was fixed. Now, so that means what? We'll be proven. We win. And then the next trial will come. You know what will happen? He's fixed that one too. We'll win again. And every time, we'll be re-proved. I'm lingering here because we don't want to hate those difficulties. We don't want to faint, become weak-kneed. And again, I'm stressing that because of this. Our emotions during that trial will impact what we do during that trial. So we're to know two things. What are the two things? The old 1-2. One, it's fixed. And secondly, God will use that to produce benefit in our life. And here's another two. What's the first? Things we know, it's fixed. We will win. Secondly, we will get benefit because of that trial. Why? Because He develops us. And he develops us in two ways. There's another two. How did he develop us? Verse 6. For those whom the Lord loves, he developmentally trains. There we go. And he, terrible translation, scourges. And let me pause and say, if he really meant what that word said, that would mean he gets a huge whip with pieces of glass and metal and bone and rips our back off with it. Does anybody think God does that? They missed it by one letter. One measly letter. It doesn't mean scourge. It's another word that means to develop specifically in the context of a gym. I actually, you might want to Google, there was a Greek Jewish philosopher named Philo. He's readily available on the internet. I read some great stuff from Philo the past couple of weeks about this very word, developmental training in a gym. And he said the two things that would happen in a gym when you had a developmental trainer is the two goals were to decrease fat and increase muscle. That makes sense. Well, you see, in a spiritual setting, that's exactly what God does for us in His gym using those trials. He gets rid of spiritual fat and gives us spiritual muscle. All right, now what is fat? Well, we know what fat is in the physical realm, don't we? I've become very acquainted with it. Become very close to me over the years. Almost a part of me, I could say. Fat is something that we carry around with us. But it's baggage. It doesn't serve any purpose. Except increasing the length of your shadow or the width of your shadow. Now, actually, it's worse than to say it doesn't serve any purpose. Baggage we carry around our bodies that hinders us, and it causes problems. Well, in a figurative, spiritual sense, that's what fat is too. It's baggage we carry in our lives. It's those old habits, those old ways of doing things, ways of interacting with people that undermine us. They trip us up. It's those self-destructive tendencies. Every one of us here has some of them. And we're probably not aware of what this tendency is. But I tell you what we are aware of. There are certain areas in our lives we always keep failing. We all have those. And part of it is we bring those same self-destructive tendencies into the situation. And it's very hard to stop it. Well, in fact, it's impossible because we don't know what it is, probably. It's too ingrained in us. It's that self-destructive fat. And now you see, that's what causes, when trials come, that's what causes the bleeding. That's what causes us to feel beaten and whipped. It's we're doing it to ourselves, and certainly not God. He's doing the opposite. In fact, when those trials come, He did not send them. However, when they do come, He marshals them into His gym. And He does us a favor by cutting out fat. Now, in a minute, I'll show you how He does that. But first, I want to point out that not only do those trials give Him the opportunity to remove fat, they give Him the opportunity to add muscle. You see, some of those situations, those adverse circumstances, are compounded by the baggage we bring to it. Self-destructive fat. Again, the trial you're in probably was not caused by that, but it certainly compounds it. But we have other situations where it's not that it's not the presence of our self-destructive tendencies. It's the absence of resources we need. Aren't there times in life when you think, well, there's resources I need, strength I need to deal with this, and I don't have it? Actually, God doesn't send it. He's not punishing us. Any adverse trial we have in life, I believe we look at it as an opportunity for God to get rid of that fat and increase muscle. But it's a supernatural process. See, in the physical realm, the process of removing fat and increasing muscle requires that we do the effort. I guarantee you, if you hire a personal trainer, you're going to have to do the exercising. He won't do it for you. I tried, it doesn't work. We have to do it. It's one of those truths in the physical realm that we tend to carry over to the spiritual realm, right? Because we know to lose fat, gain muscle in the physical realm, we've got to work. So then we start making the wrong conclusion that, well, it's the same in the spiritual realm. to get rid of the spiritual garbage in my life and increase the muscle, I've got to participate. I've got to get in there in the gym. In the spiritual realm, it's totally different. In the spiritual realm, getting rid of our fat, increasing our muscle, is totally different in God's gym. You see? And again, the best coach in the world can't just automatically melt fat and give us muscle. Don't believe those pills are selling on television. But God's a supernatural coach. And see, He has the ability by Himself to get that fat off and increase muscle by Himself. We don't help. But we can hinder. How can we hinder? Very simply, by hating those trials. By being faint during those trials. Now, what about fat? How does He use those difficulties to decrease fat? Here's how. Think about the trials of life where sometimes your ability to do something has been restricted. Or it's not there. That's really the nature of many trials. Or that's the way we experience it. Because of the situation, I need to do this, but I'm not able. I want to do this, but I'm not able. Again, isn't that very common in some kind of trial or adverse circumstance? Some ability to do something has been restricted. Something's missing. We may even think God's withholding something. Whenever you feel that or you experience that, there's no question what's happening. No question whatsoever. It's very simple. What's being restricted is fat. If there's ever a situation in our lives where there's something we feel like we need to do but we can't, I guarantee you that thing that we want to do, it would be self-destructive. And it would undermine us. It's that old fat. We have all this baggage. We keep doing it the same way. We're not connecting the dots that it keeps causing us to fail because we're not aware of it. So what God does is put us in a situation we are not able to do that thing that undermines us. In other words, if God withholds something from us, some ability for us to do something, I'll tell you this, that if we could do that thing, it would be wrong. Psalm 84:11 sums it up. No good thing does He withhold. And then they translate it from those who walk uprightly, making it sound like if we're nice, He'll give us things. If we're not, He won't. No. It doesn't say those who walk uprightly, and I hope I changed it. It says from those who are the righteous. There's a big difference between the word walk and the word are, isn't there? Walk means what we do. Are means what we are. Who are the righteous? People who have been born again by faith in Jesus. Those are the righteous. It's not how we walk. It's who we are. Let's just do the math here. No good thing will He withhold from believers. Just think about that for a minute. He will not withhold any good thing from a believer. All right. What if we're in a situation where He's withheld something? Then what does that mean? It wasn't good. Doesn't that make sense? He does not withhold any good thing. So if He does withhold something, it was not a good thing. Now the problem is it would seem like a good thing to us, and that's why we hate those trials. We say, well, He's taken that from me. I don't have the ability to do that. We're thinking that's good. He's saying, trust me, it's one of those old, undermining, self-fat, self-destructive tendencies that we have. That's all He's removed, but you see, that's why the trials seem painful to us. That's why we beat our head against the wall. Well, I can't do that. The point is, you don't want to do that. We may think, well, if I could do this, then this would work out great. God's saying, no, if you could do that, it would cause you to undermine yourself again. Now, the beauty of these trials is, God didn't send them, but then He tailor makes them in His gym. And what He's doing is, He's putting us in a situation we are totally unable to exercise that self-destructive tendency that we always do. Now, since we can't do it, you know what happens is we stop trying to do it. And this is all unconsciously, I believe. We stop trying to do it because we can't anymore. Automatically, you know what happens supernaturally? That trait, that self-destructive tendency, melts away from our life like fat. It withers away. And we're probably not even aware that it happened. But some self-destructive tendencies being whittled away from our lives. Now, it's all God's doing. We don't help. What do we do? Very simply. When the trials come, don't despise them and don't grow faint. That's how He gets rid of fat. Now, what about muscle? By the way, we don't want just fat removed. We need muscle. But one of my favorite fighters was Muhammad Ali. Because he knew how to roll with the punches. He didn't get afraid. Of course, if I get punched like him, I wouldn't have been afraid either. He would roll. He would dance like a butterfly because he didn't have fat. But he had the muscle to sting like a bee. Isn't that what we want? We want to get rid of that fat so we can dance like a butterfly. But we want the muscle sometimes to sting like a bee when we need. We've seen how he gets rid of fat. By blocking off our ability to use those self-destructive tendencies in our lives. How does he increase muscle? Oh, that's even easier. That's an even easier process. Now remember, it begins with removing fat. We'll have a trial in our life. I can't do this. This has been restricted. This ability has been withheld. What do? Well, because we can't do it, we automatically stop doing it. Because we're not able to do it, those old habits drop off. Here's the beauty of it. As the fat melts off from us, we are automatically forced to let God do things. Does that make sense? If we have trial, I can't do this. Well, God has to start moving in this situation because I've lost all ability to. My fat melts away, but then you know what happens? God's muscle automatically starts increasing in us. And we get more muscle, but it's all His. It's a new kind of muscle. So you see, those trials come. He's not punishing us. It's for our benefit. Gets rid of fat, the old self-destructive tendencies. And as our fat drops off, He increases our muscle. But it's not ours. It's His muscle. Now, let's add those two processes together. If we can get rid of spiritual fat, those self-destructive tendencies keep doing the wrong thing to keep undermining us. And if we can add muscle, the strength to do what we should do. If we had no fat and all muscle, do you realize that in our lives, everything that we did would be right? I mean, it's just simple math. Get rid of the self-destructive tendencies. Get rid of the tendencies to do things wrong. Increase the part of us that does things right. If we approach life that way, we would do everything right. And that is the ultimate purpose of trials. There may be some specific purposes, a little fat issue here, a little muscle increase here. Ultimately, they're all for the same thing. So after the trial, and it will be over, we will come out of it doing things right. See, the purpose of the trial is not to whip us, it's to prevent us from being whipped. And again, though, it certainly seems painful during those times, doesn't it? Yes, it does. But you see why? There's all kinds of reasons it seems painful. We're not able to do something. If we'd realize, whatever I'm not able to do is something that's bad. I'm fighting away at myself. I'm beating my head against the wall. God says, calm down. You're hurting yourself. I'm not doing it. Now, again, I guess the main reason it feels painful is this. And let's think back to the analogy of fat and muscle. Because, you see, that way we'll understand why it does not seem pleasant. Think of the physical realm. None of us want fat. The problem is, the process of putting fat on our bodies is enjoyable. Or, eating is fun. Is a simple way to say it. And you know what I've noticed? The food that's the most fun to eat is the one that puts the most fat on us. I don't know why it has to work that way. I've always thought, God, why can't you make a wonderful tasting broccoli? Is that too hard? Make Brussels sprouts and taste good. That's all I want. But we want those fatty things. I've been taking a walk most weekends around our little park. And there's a duck pond there. And there's all these ducks. There's a whole generation of ducks, and all they eat are junk food that people bring them. They don't even hang out in the lake. They hang out by the benches. I want that. I want those Cheetos. That's the problem. I had not eaten a Snickers bar in a long time. Actually, I had not eaten a Snickers in a long time. And a few years ago, I was at a company event in Florida, and they catered our lunch. They gave us all a little sack, and there was a sandwich, pickle, bottle water, and a Snickers bar. Oh, yes. Snickers bar. A moment on the lips, forever on the hips. I thought, you know, why does it have to be that something that tastes that good puts that much fat on? And while I was supposed to be listening to speakers, I got my calculator right because I looked at the calories on that thing. It had the number of calories, the number of ounces. And I calculated over and over because I couldn't believe what I was checking. I kept doing the math and I realized something. You eat that Snickers bar, you will gain more weight than the stupid bar weighs itself. Don't know how that can be. But you see, the process of increasing fat is enjoyable. However, the other side, the process for increasing muscle is not enjoyable in the physical realm. And we could say it this way, in a spiritual sense, sweating is not fun. Actually, we're only glad for the fat removal and muscle increase after the fact. I've been walking for several months now. Almost every Saturday and Sunday. Many, many times. I know one thing. There's not been one time I wanted to go do it. Not one single time. Oh, especially during the heat of the summer. No, I did not want to go. And even during my walk, run, whatever, I was not enjoying it. In fact, I'd carry a watch. I think, oh, I must have been out 30 minutes. 10. Not pleasant. However, it was not pleasant before, it was not pleasant during, but afterwards, it's great. Rest and sleep, it's great. But the benefit only comes after. And that's the way it is when those trials that decrease fat and increase muscle come to us. Verse 11. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Right. This, the trial is not pleasant. I'm not able to do these things. It's not pleasant. Verse 11. But there's benefit. Yet to those who have been trained, and there's that word developed in a gym by it. Look at this. Afterwards. Afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Just like you feel better after you exercise. He says, you'll feel better when this trial is over. And isn't that important? He says two things. One, I've fixed it. I've rigged it. You're going to win. And secondly, there will be benefits when it's over. So you see in the spiritual realm when those trials come, what he says is, you'll come out of this trial with less fat and more of my muscle. And I tell you, we will know the difference. And he says that will yield the peaceful fruit of righteousness. That's what I think when I finish the exercise. That's the way I feel. Now, when I say the peaceful fruit of righteousness, it'd be very easy to get religious with that phrase, wouldn't it? Oh, yeah. The peaceful fruit of righteousness. Oh, I could tell you all we need to start obeying. All of you need to become more righteous. I just can't do it with a straight face. Yes. Yes, dear. Actually, we don't want to think religious concepts here. Righteous just means doing what's right. God is righteous because everything He does is right. See? And we, now positionally, we are 100% righteous. In our lives, what does that mean? That means on our book in heaven, every checklist, every bullet list is checked off. We did everything right. Why? Because Jesus forged our account and put His record in our book. So, we're righteous because, positionally, we've done everything righteous. Now, in our lives, how is righteousness manifested? By being very religious? No, no. In our lives, righteousness is manifested as we do the right things in every situation. That's what righteousness means. Now, to start to put all this together. If a trial comes, we despise it. We go faint. We're afraid. We will do what's wrong. We can never forget that. If we're in a situation we hate what's happening, we're going faint, we're getting afraid, we will do what's wrong. Why? Because that's that fat, that's the baggage, that's the undermining, self-undermining tendencies coming out. We'll do what's wrong. And let me tell you a classic example we find from Jeremiah. Israel was in a time of trial, great trial. And how did they respond? The two things we're not supposed to do. They hated it and they became faint. And Lamentations 5:17, Jeremiah specifically outlines the sequence. He says, first, there's been a trial. Secondly, because of this, our heart is faint. See that? Trial came. Because of this, our heart is faint. There's the word. And then what happened? There's another step in the sequence. Because of these things, what? What does that mean? Our heart being faint, our eyes are dim. We can't see clearly. Ooh, what does that mean? You can't do what's correct. We don't want to miss the sequence here in Lamentations 5:17. The sequence here is this. First came the trial. Then came fear. Then came the inability to see what was right. And then came the inability to do what was right. And they started beating their heads against the wall and thinking God's punishing them. And God's saying, you keep beating your head against the brick wall. I'm not punishing you. Guarantee you that's what we do. You see, our attitude about a trial impacts our lives. We hate it. We grow faint. That'll be the same sequence to us. Well, here's the sequence. Proverbs 29:18. Where there's no vision, that means no clear vision. The people perish. Ooh, that's pretty strong. It means the people are out of control. Where there is no clear vision, the people are out of control. Get the sequence there? I'll say it again. Here's the sequence. We want to pay careful attention because I bet this will have all kinds of red flags in our lives. A trial comes. Secondly, we despise it. We grow faint. We worry. How's it going to come out? We become afraid. Then, what happens? The fear clouds our judgment. We can't see what to do. What's the next step? We will not do what's right. The current trial will be compounded, and it will trigger future trials. And Jeremiah himself is the classic example. At the time of Jeremiah, Babylon was conquering the world, and Babylon was just about to conquer Israel. And there were two factions in Israel. One faction said, fight back, resist Babylon. The second faction said, submit to Babylon. And the two parties were extremely hostile to each other. It's hard to imagine a country where you have two parties hostile to each other. I know we can't fathom that, but that's the way it was then. It was the fighters and the submitters. Now, Jeremiah took a position that surprised many people. Jeremiah said, submit to Nebuchadnezzar. Submit to the Babylonians. Why do you say that? Because God told him, submit to the Babylonians. That's the way to have a pleasant life. Oh, but he gained some powerful enemies when he took that stance. And the faction that wanted to fight Babylon started coming after Jeremiah. That was a trial, and Jeremiah had the wrong attitude to begin with. Lamentation 3:52, Jeremiah says, my enemies, without cause, hunted me down like a bird. He's getting faint. You know why? He thought they want to kill him. What did he not understand? He did not understand the fight was fixed. And what's the second thing he didn't understand? Not only is it fixed, something of benefit to you will come out of this. Instead, he grew faint. In his own words, 1:13, he is made me desolate, faint. All day long. 2:11, my eyes fail because of tears. My spirit is greatly troubled. You think he has a right understanding of that trial? No. He's faint. He's despising it. He thinks they're going to kill me. And then, of course, he does what we do. Well, God must be punishing me. 1:18, for I have rebelled against his commandments. Chapter 3, verse 1. I am the man who has seen affliction because of the rod of his wrath. Let me remind you, this is the same Jeremiah who in Jeremiah 31 said, God says, I won't even remember your sins anymore. And now Jeremiah is saying, oh, he's beating me. Look how extreme he gets. 3:10, he's like a bear lying in wait, like a lion in secret places. That is the mighty prophet Jeremiah speaking here. He's saying, God's hiding out for me to pounce on me when I do wrong. He made the arrows of his quiver to enter into my inward parts. Ooh. 1:14, the Lord has given me into the hands of those against whom I am not able to stand. We cannot miss that. What he just said was the key. The Lord has given me into the hands of those against whom I'm not able to stand. That's exactly what God did to him. He made him not able to stand against them. He restricted something. He withdrew something from Jeremiah's life. But remember what we've learned? Whenever there's a situation in our life, when there's something I feel like I need to do, I'm not able. God has restricted that. Why? Because it's fat. Remember, whatever God restricts in our lives, we can never forget this. Whatever He restricts in our lives would be something that would be bad. Because you see, what was happening is Jeremiah kept trying to exercise a self-destructive tendency. And he had a self-destructive tendency, which was to lash out. He had a lot of self-destructive tendencies. Jeremiah would be... He had a tendency to fear, greatly fear. He had deep depression. And then he'd become passive-aggressive, and then he would lash out. So what's happening is he's trying to fight that faction coming to him. And Jeremiah said, "You don't let me fight them." And God's saying, "No, because I don't want you to fight them." Doesn't that make sense? Anything restricted from our life would be something bad. So, but then he thought like we do, "Well, I'm being punished, and that means loss of fellowship." 3:8, "Even when I cry out and call for help, he shuts out my prayer." Now, here's what happened, why he said that. His enemies came and got him finally, and they put him down in a pit. So he says in 3:7, "He has walled me in so that I cannot go out. He has made my chain heavy." It's amazing. He thought he was being punished and God was delivering. You see, the reason God put him in that pit was that Jeremiah was doing what we do. A trial came, he became frantic, faint, fearful, started running around like crazy, beating his head against a wall, flailing away. God had to restrict his ability to do that because it was wrong. God had to put him in a pit. Why? Because the people coming at him were not going to kill him. The people coming at him were going to take him to Egypt. The safest place to be in the world at that time. And what was really great, see, God had fixed it. He had rigged the fight. They didn't kill him, and they took him to Egypt. And by the way, he went to Egypt not walking, which is the way he normally went, but on a coach. So when that trial came, what was God's purpose? To get rid of that fat, fear in his life, and to increase his muscle, to bring benefit to his life by getting him to Egypt in a coach. That was the whole point. Jeremiah's going, "I keep praying for you to get me out of this pit, and you won't answer my prayer." And God be saying, "The pit is the way to get you to Egypt. You don't want to be out of the pit." He said, "But I'm not able to do these things." God says, "What those things are? That things you think you're not able to do are things that keep undermining you." He thought he wasn't answering his prayer. God's going, "Hang on, calm down." And we read, know from Lamentations that he was beating his head against the side of that pit the whole time and thinking, "Why is God punishing me?" And God's going, "You're beating your stupid head against the wall." Although God didn't say stupid, but I do. Great point. Yes, that's Jeremiah's very twisted perception of what was happening. Yes, and the way to counter it, read the last few chapters of Jeremiah and compare the two, because we get God's perspective of what he was doing. In the book of Jeremiah, he's saying, "I'm delivering you, Jeremiah." In Jeremiah, in Lamentations, he's saying, "You're killing me." It's just awesome. James chapter 1 sort of sums this all up. "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials." Now, I read this and I think, well, I can't do that. I cannot be joyful in a trial. But then I look again and I see he didn't say that. He said, "Consider it all joy." The word "consider" is actually an accounting term. It's a bookkeeping term. And it means when you look at this trial you're in, put it down on your assets column, not the liabilities. He's saying, "You're not telling us to feel that way. Give me a break." He said, "I know it doesn't feel joyful." He said, "But trust me on this. Mentally put it down on that assets column. This is going to be something good." Knowing that the testing, not testing, it's proving. The proving of your faith. What does that mean? Well, we've already seen. He's already rigged it. It'll be proven that we win. Produces, and then it says produces endurance. It's not that word. In fact, it's almost the opposite. It's resilient. Resilience. And that's different from endurance. You see, if we're endurance, we're like the Incredible Hulk. I think we think that's what trials do, make me strong. No, resilience means roll with the flow. Roll with those punches. He doesn't want us to be like the Incredible Hulk. He wants us to be like Fonzie. Walk through life saying, "Yo, see? Roll with the punch." He said, "Be resilient. What happens is in trials we become the opposite. We freeze up. We withdraw. We grit our teeth. I'm going to endure this. And all we do is make ourselves so hard that when we hit our head against the wall, we crack. He says to make you resilient. Why? Well, isn't that what losing fat and increasing muscle does? It makes us resilient in life. We don't have that baggage of the self-destructive tendencies. They're going away. We become resilient. And let the resilience, there we go, have its perfect result. That means the completed result God had in mind, so that you may be perfect, yes, and complete, lacking in nothing. Meaning, not having the fat, the self-destructive tendencies, but having enough muscle and punch to deal with things. 1 John 4:18, there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. It's the same word that we see in James, the word perfect. It means love that brings us to our... Perfect love means love from God that brings about its desired completion. What is that? Less fat, more muscle. Why do we have sorrow and worry and trials? Here's why. Because fear involves punishment. See that? Here's the sequence. If we think He's punishing us, we will become afraid. And then what will happen? Then the one who fears is not perfected in love. What does it mean, perfected? He means that process of removing fat, self-destructive tendencies, increasing his muscle. He says, if you're afraid during that trial, if you think God's punishing you, you are short-circuiting the process that God uses to get rid of that fat and increase the muscle. Isaiah 40:31. Those who wait for the Lord. What does that mean? Well, when trials come, we can wait expectantly. Why? Because it's been fixed. It's been rigged. We'll come out with benefit. He says, if you do that, we'll gain new strength. And notice he does not say, we'll gain more strength. Did you catch that? It's not more strength. It's not more of our strength. It's new strength. It's a supernatural strength. He burns the fat off, increases his muscle. It's automatic. So, let's look at our two things again. Trials come, we have two misconceptions. Two wrong attitudes. We hate it, we fear it. Actually, God's doing two things. He's fixed the fight, so we'll win. Secondly, He'll produce benefit. How? Two ways. Removing fat, increasing muscle. I hope we never again think of discipline the way we used to before this passage. Connie?
Most of this has to do with our attitude, how He is changing the way we look at things. So He's changing our soul, which is, well, really we should be talking about growth in the soul. You said before you cannot grow in the spirit.
Right.
Perfect, but this is growing in our soul, and it will play out even in our physical body.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we don't grow spiritually. We're already 100% perfect. The growth occurs in our soul. We become resilient. Our mind, will, and emotions. Yeah. Father, again, we thank You for this powerful chapter. Thank You for these word pictures You carefully planted in here. Above all, we thank You that when those difficulties come, although You did not send them, You marshal them into Your gym, and there You take control. We thank You that supernaturally You guarantee that the fight is fixed, we'll win, and more than that, we will benefit from it. Just enable us to remember not to hate it, not to despise it, and not to grow fearful. Above all, we thank You for Jesus, whose sacrificial, substitutionary death on the cross on our behalf enabled us to have this relationship with You. And we thank You in Jesus' name this morning. Amen.